B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comments. It's Wednesday, April 12th, 2017. Thanks for grabbing my daily free news and comment podcast. It's available at all my outlets, including YouTube. And I hope you'll spread the word and share it far and wide. A salute and shout out to Aaron Mate. Don't know Aaron, but he's a reporter at The Intercept, and he did something that I've been waiting for a while. He did a breakdown of the story coverage on the Rachel Maddow nightly program on MSNBC. Yes, I often call it MSDNC, and lately I've taken to calling it Pravda, because Rachel Maddow has been truly obsessed with Russia. And some of her reporting has been interesting, different from the rest of the corporate media. But the folks at The Intercept actually analyzed her coverage over the last 6 weeks and discovered that more than half, about 53%, of her show has been focused on Russia. And they say that that doesn't even include some segments where Russia was peripherally a factor. So this quantifies something that I have been noticing. And The Intercept also does a great job of pointing out what gets squeezed out when Rachel goes deep on Trump-Russia. So, for example, her coverage has dwarfed the time devoted to other top issues. For example, the crackdown on undocumented immigrants has garnered only 1.3% of her airtime. Obamacare repeal under 4%. The legal battle over the travel ban and the Muslim ban, just over 5%. A surge of anti-GOP activism in the town hall, she's covered that but briefly, 5.8% of her airtime. And the Trump administration scandals and stumbles, well, she makes room for that. That's been about 11% of her coverage. But when you think critically and look at the arc of her show, and let me stipulate that she can do whatever she wants on her program. It is personality-driven, advocacy journalism. She claims that she's not really an opinion person, but her point of view comes across very clearly. And the shift has been that a year ago, while we were all excited about the challenging Democratic primary between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, all of her coverage was about Trump and the Republicans. It was opposition research of the GOP. And one other analysis here that's part of the Intercept's piece is that in 16 of 28 episodes that were analyzed, Russia comprised either all or a substantial part of the A block. That is the lead segment where she can run as far as 21 or 22 minutes without pausing for a commercial. And my frustration is that in that long block that she enjoys without commercial interruption, she'll take a story that might take 4 or 5 minutes to relate, and she just repeats things over and over again in a maddening and frustrating manner. And if she would edit herself a little bit and reduce some of that flowery, flourishing stuff that she does, we might actually get a higher story count, as they say, in newsrooms, and learn more from spending an hour with Rachel Maddow. So The Intercept also takes a look at some of the specific items that she has covered or failed to cover. For example, on March 7, WikiLeaks published documents exposing cyber tools used by the CIA to penetrate cell phones and other devices, and also to mask your location. In other words, some of those hacking devices were enabled the CIA to pretend, for example, that they were Russian intelligence. She didn't really bother to emphasize that point, if she reported it at all. And she has omitted the widely circulated reports that U.S. intelligence officials believe that the CIA's own contractors were behind the cyber tools leak. And here's another example that is a little embarrassing to the Maddow team, because, you know, they talk about how RT, the Russian-owned network that's on American cable channels where Tom Hartman and Ed Schultz and Chris Hedges have programs? Well, she describes it as the state media of Russia. And it's something in between an American network and Russian state media. I'll allow that. But, for example, she noted that RT had advanced knowledge of WikiLeaks' release of the hacked Podesta emails. Based on RT's Twitter account, reporting the release 19 minutes before WikiLeaks' Twitter account did it. And Rachel spun up a lot of doubt and, you know, a possible conspiracy, when it turns out that the people at RT just went to the WikiLeaks website and reported it because it had been posted there, but Julian hadn't gotten around to tweeting it yet. So some of this is dramatized, exaggerated, and in some cases, it feeds the conspiratorial mindset that is at the core of Maddow's recent coverage. Here's another example. March 7th, Maddow led with the day's top story, the unveiling of Republican plans to repeal Obamacare. If you're worried about losing your health insurance, if you're worried about 20 million of your fellow Americans losing their health insurance, today was very scary, but after 2 minutes she shifted to Russia. And a story about a Russian air freight company that was implicated in some corruption. So this is just, I think, a very useful analysis. And I hope people who watch the Maddow Show on a daily basis, and I do, I watch it and I think that she does some things well, and it's the omissions that I have the greatest problem with. And I'm linking to the Intercept's report. It's in the show file for today's podcast, and I encourage you to read it carefully. Yesterday on Facebook, I put out a call asking people to relay my post to Rachel Maddow and asking her to issue a correction. She does occasionally do that, and I applaud that. When I make a mistake, I try to correct it. And the mistake I would like her to correct is that she gave credit to an Alabama reporter named John Archibald for breaking the LoveGov story that led to the resignation of Governor Robert Bentley on Monday, when it's very clear that Roger Shuler broke that story, covered it at least 6 months before Archibald did, and Archibald spent a period of time trying to dismiss Shuler's report, saying that it was just a lot of smoke or hot air. And Maddow praised Archibald, claimed he was the guy who broke the story and nurtured it along. Well, I hope she will find a minute or two to properly credit Roger Shuler. Meanwhile, the Trump-Russia investigations and the controversies over it have produced one new break. Of course, this is based on anonymous leaks from intelligence officials, this time to the Washington Post. But the Post says it has seen the secret court order that was issued by the super-secret FISA court last summer to monitor the communications of Carter Page, who was a loosely described advisor to Donald Trump. Now, records indicate that the two never actually met face-to-face. So Carter Page's contributions to the Trump campaign may be as limited as the campaign of the White House is now trying to persuade us. But the history shows, and I'll credit Rachel Maddow, she has helped expose this, that Carter Page was the subject of an attempt by Russian spies to recruit him. And it appears from their perspective that they succeeded. Going back to 2013, they got Carter Page to share documents about the U.S. energy industry, and he was scratching their backs because he thought they could open doors for him for energy deals in Russia. Now, Carter Page says, I've got nothing to hide, I'm innocent. He's a guy who blabs a lot and has already given interviews that don't particularly help his case. But he's saying that this is a witch hunt, that this is an abuse of the spying powers of our government. Of quote, "This confirms all of my suspicions about unjustified, politically motivated government surveillance," said Page in an interview yesterday. "I have nothing to hide." Well, the report is that the FISA warrant was issued last July to allow the FBI to monitor the communications of Carter Page based on probable cause that he was an agent of the Russian government and knowingly engaged in clandestine intelligence activities on behalf of Moscow. Now, keep in mind that all of this is based on anonymous leaks supplied to the Washington Post. And we have James Comey in an act of national security theater. He was recently quoted as saying that applications for these FISA warrants are thicker than Jim Comey's wrists, and that thickness represents all the work Justice Department attorneys and FBI agents have to do to convince a judge that such surveillance is appropriate in an investigation. Now, what bullshit is this? The FISA court rarely rejects a request for a warrant. I mean, over the years, there are only a handful of cases that we know of where the court has said either come back with a better, more focused request or have denied a request. So this is a secret rubber stamp court, and Comey tries to make it seem like, oh, the standards are so high. And the reason I call bullshit on this is my most recent in-depth interview with Bill Binney. It's on the website right now. We released it last week. And Binney says that it's unlikely that Trump and his associates and their phone calls were intercepted by a FISA warrant order. He said, no, it came from the bulk collection. My calls, your calls, Carter Page's calls, Donald Trump's calls, everybody's calls are sucked up by the NSA. It's whose calls they decide to listen back to that, you know, create that legal point where they're actually violating the law. And I believe that they routinely violate the law. And this pretense from Comey and others that these rigorous standards are always adhered to, I simply do not believe. So we're going to see where this goes. Carter Page, as I said, was a peripheral figure in the Trump campaign, based on everything I know. And so I'm not sure that this really will lead to anything substantial, but it's a very important and interesting story, again, based on anonymous sources and calculated leaks. Meanwhile, Rex Tillerson went to Moscow after telling people on Tuesday that the Russian government was involved in a cover-up of the chemical incident in the town of Farshakun. I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me, but the town in Syria in Idlib province last week. And a four-page report drawn up by the National Security Council contains declassified United States intelligence on the attack and a rebuttal of Moscow's claim that insurgents unleashed the gas to frame the Syrian government. Instead, the White House asserted that Damascus and Moscow had released false narratives to mislead the world. Now, that's entirely possible. But I have to place more trust in the Trump White House and a four-page report that's been declassified but not made public. And so, can we rely on their assertions? Can we rely on the intelligence assessments of our spook agencies? Well, for me, I haven't seen enough proof, and I hope you've had a chance to listen to my powerful interview posted yesterday with former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, because he raised important questions about the need for a true independent investigation. And Vladimir Putin is saying the same thing. He wants a full international investigation. And he speculated, this strongly resembles what happened in 2003 when representatives of the United States showed in the Security Council what was supposed to be chemical weapons found in Iraq. A military campaign in Iraq ensued, and it ended in devastation of the country, growth of the terror threat, and emergence of ISIL on the international scene. So, as Tillerson arrived in Moscow today, Trump played hard to get, not Trump, Putin. I'm going to leave this in. I'm not going to correct my error. Putin played hard to get. He first had Tillerson meet with Sergei Lavrov, their equivalent foreign secretary. And then he had Rex Tillerson, his good old buddy from the ExxonMobil days, who got that Friend of Russia award a couple of years ago from Vlad personally. He made him cool his heels for hours. Finally agreed to meet with him, I guess, about 6 o'clock local time. And they met for about 2 hours. But the other important comment coming from Putin, quote, "We have information from various sources that similar provocations, and I have no other word for that, are being prepared in the other regions of Syria, including southern suburbs of Damascus, where they intend to plant certain substance again and accuse official Syrian authorities of using it." Now, that's a pretty strong statement. And it will be interesting to hear fuller reports of what the exchange between Tillerson and Putin included. But the word coming out of Moscow is that Lavrov has said that Putin might agree to resume the deconfliction network. That's the hotline where we say, hey, Russia, we're putting planes in the air over Syria. Don't knock them down and tell us where yours are so we don't run into your planes. So in what was effectively an ultimatum, that's what Tillerson and the White House issued yesterday. In addition to the claim of Russian cover-up, they also are trying to separate Russia from Syria by saying that the costs of remaining an ally of Assad are going to be too great. And then, of course, Tillerson, channeling Barack Obama, says, you know, well, the Assad regime will be stepping down. It's just a matter of when and how. And these are dangerous statements to make, especially in the presence of the Russians, who now have a pretty deep investment in maintaining the Assad government in the face of U.S. and Western efforts to take it out. So we'll have to see a little bit more. There was a post-meeting press conference hosted by Lavrov with Tillerson, and both admit that U.S.-Russia relations are at a new low. They are marked by distrust. And Tillerson said, "The current state of U.S.-Russian relations is at a low point. There's a low level of trust between our two countries. That the world's two foremost nuclear powers cannot have this sort of relationship." And this is a bizarre column. I have linked to Tom Friedman's latest op-ed in the New York Times. And Tom Friedman was the guy during the occupation of Iraq under the Bush administration who kept saying, you know, just 6 more months. The tide will turn in 6 more months. We just need to give it 6 more months. Well, Mr. 6 More Months doesn't have much patience these days, and he is demanding that Donald Trump listen to him, let the Russians and the Syrians defeat the Islamic State, and set back and work on other priorities. He says that he parses it this way, that there is territorial ISIS, the land, the geography that they hold in Syria and Iraq. And then there is virtual ISIS, which is the network of terrorists and sympathizers that many, I think, exaggerate the threat from. But I acknowledge that there is some threat. So he says we should dramatically increase our military aid to anti-Assad rebels, giving them sufficient anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Now, this was the strategy that Obama tried, the so-called moderate rebels. The ones who had been vetted that we can trust, we give them weapons, and then they either walk away and leave them for ISIS and Al-Qaeda, or they sell them to them or give them to them as part of different ploys that occur in a complex battlefield like Syria. Friedman goes on to say, this is a time for Trump to be Trump, utterly cynical and unpredictable. Trump should want to defeat ISIS in Iraq, but in Syria? Not for free and not now. In Syria, Trump should let ISIS be Assad's, Iran's, Hezbollah's, and Russia's headache. Oh, wow. These are bizarre times. Yesterday, I reported to you that Trump tweeted some love notes and love threats to Xi Jinping, the leader of China, that he hosted in Florida last week. And after the tweets, he followed up with a phone call, and he is leaning on China to pressure North Korea to stop its nuclear and its missile tests. And a prominent state-run newspaper in China is warning North Korea that it faces a cutoff of vital oil supplies, almost all of which come from China, if it dares to test a nuclear weapon. Now, this weekend is the, 105th birthday or anniversary of the birth, of Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, and his grandson is expected to use the occasion, that's Kim Jong-un, to either stage a nuclear weapons test or conduct a missile test in direct defiance of the U.S. and its main patron. We, of course, have a carrier task force, and in an interview this morning, Trump was bragging about how our submarines are so beautiful and even more deadly than our aircraft carriers. His statements are so weird. Anyway, there is a true escalation of tensions. And Trump believes that his unpredictability after the attack on Syria last week makes him a stronger bully and bluff artist with Kim Jong-un. But this is a desperate little guy. He's isolated from the world. And I think that ratcheting up tensions could lead to a miscalculation by Kim Jong-un. And the border there on the 38th parallel is highly populated on both sides. And even a non-nuclear conflict of a short duration could lead to the loss of a lot of life. But Trump is undaunted. There's nobody who can really talk him down from his arrogance and his overcompensation for his lack of self-confidence, which is what really, I think, gets him into a lot of trouble. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Willem Gruters in Holland is a longtime subscriber. Candace Brunlinger just took out a new annual subscription. Thank you, Candace. And Carl Howard, Susan Gavet, they are longtime monthly subscribers to this podcast. I encourage you to join them. We've had some new signups in the last couple of days. Thank you. But let's keep it going. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link that says menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and you can choose a level you're comfortable with. If you take out a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., I will reward you with the bonus book of your choice. They're displayed on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. So I'm not sure quite how to take this, because Trump loves to play his staff one off against the other. He likes to have that kind of tension that he thinks, gives him the best out of an individual by, squeezing their nuts. Anyway, in an interview with the New York Post on Tuesday, Trump seemed to deliberately hammer Steve Bannon. And he said some things that you really can't believe. This is the kind of amnesia that Trump develops when it's convenient to distance himself from somebody who's been a critical player on his team. So he told the Post, I didn't know Steve before he joined the campaign. And you have to remember, he was not involved in my campaign until very late. I'd already beaten all the senators and all the governors, and I didn't know Steve. I'm my own strategist, and it wasn't like I was going to change strategies because I was facing crooked Hillary. Well, let's keep in mind that Trump had Corey Lewandowski, who he fired and replaced with Paul Manafort, who he fired and replaced with Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway. And to claim that he didn't really know Steve Bannon, well, he appeared on Bannon's satellite radio show on many occasions. So were they lunch companions, golf buddies? Maybe not. But to say, I didn't know him. Well, that's the way he says he didn't know Felix Sater, the corrupt Russian criminal and mobster who was exposed in the excellent investigative piece by Who, What, Why 2 weeks ago. And clearly, Bannon and his antics in the White House, he's certainly rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He's also competing for ego space with the big man. And I think that is his ultimate sin. We'll see how far this goes, whether Trump is just knocking the heads together of his stooges, or if Bannon is, in fact, on the way out. Now, it's really hard to describe the low point reached by Sean Spicer in the White House press briefing yesterday. He was training to justify the attack on Syria and claiming, of course, that the use of chemical weapons to kill beautiful babies is somehow much, much worse than using Tomahawk cruise missiles. But Spicer really blew it when he said, you know, even Hitler didn't use chemical weapons. Anybody who's been to the Holocaust Museum or who's been to one of the death camps like I have at Dachau, you could never make a statement like that. Millions of people were gassed to death. Were they chemical weapons dropped from an airplane? No. They were spewed into rooms that the prisoners thought were showers. And this shows how really stupid Sean Spicer is. His sense of history for a guy who's fronting for a presidential administration is sharply limited, almost as much as his imagination and his vocabulary. And while he's a feisty guy who goes out there every day and wrestles with the press just the way Trump dictates to him, he's an inarticulate idiot who tries to take on Trump's bully persona and routinely fails. He's a loser. I wonder when Trump's going to figure that out. There's another story surfacing about a passenger ill-treated by United Airlines. This is related by David Lazarus, a talented reporter, used to write for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's at the LA Times now. He tells the story of Joff Ferns, a 59-year-old banker. He's the president of Tri-Pacific Capital Advisors based in Southern California. He had been in Honolulu. Actually, he was on the Big Island for a meeting. He had a first-class seat. He was in it, sipping his complimentary orange juice, or maybe it was champagne, when a flight attendant came on and said, "Sorry, somebody more important than you wants your seat." That's not quite what it's... They told me they needed the seat for somebody more important who came at the last minute. They said they have a priority list and this other person was higher on the list than me. But he held his ground. He said, "I'm not leaving the plane." And he ultimately was persuaded or coerced, after being threatened with handcuffs, into moving into the cheap seats. Yeah, he sat in tourist class in a middle seat on a five-hour flight between a couple that was in the middle of a heated argument. And it's hard to know which was worse, his treatment by the flight crew or the fact that they stuck him between these two domestic warriors. So when he got back, he called United and said, actually, he wrote them a letter. And he said, "I want a full refund, and I want you to donate $25,000 to a charity of my choice." The airline haggled over the refund. They said, "We'll pay you the difference between your coach seat and the first-class seat that we bumped you out of, but that's all. And, about the $25,000 to a charity." So Jerry Frescia, who's a regular listener to the Peter B. Collins podcast, sent a note with some advice. He said, if you are involuntarily denied boarding, the Department of Transportation regulates what you're entitled to. Here are a couple of points. If you're bumped involuntarily and the airline arranges substitute transportation to get you to your final destination with an hour of your original scheduled arrival time, there is no compensation. If the substitute transportation gets you there between 1 and 2 hours, the airline must pay you an amount equal to 200% of your one-way fare, with a $675 maximum. If the substitute transportation is scheduled to get you there more than 2 hours later from the original schedule, or if the airline doesn't make any substitute travel arrangements for you, the compensation doubles to a maximum of $1,350. So there are some rules, but they're not encoded in law. When there was a Flyers Bill of Rights promoted by a woman I've interviewed many times who lives up in Napa, just north of me, and I'm sorry I can't summon her name right now, they negotiated a deal that is not binding on the airlines. And I predict that more of these ugly incidents are going to surface in the media very soon. Scott Pruitt is in a pickle. He's the guy who's now running the EPA, part of the Trump wrecking crew. And he, with great flourish, announced that he was rolling back the Clean Power Plan, the Obama administration's EPA rules to limit emissions from coal-fired power plants. But a growing chorus of critics on the far right are saying that he didn't go far enough, and in particular, that he has refused to challenge the underlying endangerment finding that says that continued operation of coal-fired power plants endangers the people and the planet. And without removing this, it permits lawsuits from environmentalists to proceed in the future. Some of the blistering advice is coming from Stephen Malloy, who runs a website called junkscience.com. He used to work for Murray Energy, one of the biggest coal companies in the country, and a major backer of Trump. And he says, look, if you get rid of the endangerment finding, the rest of the climate regulations just sweep themselves away. But if you don't, the environmentalists can sue, and then there's going to have to be a Trump clean power plan. But Pruitt says it won't work to do that. And he's even being hammered by Breitbart News. Another EPA story coming from our friend Steve Horn at the Smog Blog today. Last week, a judge in Pennsylvania overruled a unanimous jury verdict that awarded over $4 million to families whose drinking water was poisoned as a result of the fracking process in the Marcellus Shale. It's a blockbuster of a story. I've linked to it in the show file. There's a lot of detail here, but fundamentally, families that discovered that their water was poisoned or tainted sued after they rejected a settlement that would have required them to keep quiet. And so the magistrate judge, Martin Carlson, has discarded the jury's verdict and ordered a new trial. He's also ordered the parties to try to settle before a new trial. But this is an unusual move to nullify a jury verdict in this manner. I find it alarming, and I hope you'll take a look at the article. And finally today, we say farewell to a man who was born John Warren Giles Jr., but better known as the frontman of the Jay Giles Band. In my humble opinion, one of the best Boston blues bands ever. I got to see them live two or three times, and Giles with his lead singer, Peter Wolf, with the harmonica player, I think his name was Magic Dick, they put on a hell of a show. And due to my restrictions from YouTube, I can't play their music here right now, but I've put up a link to one of my favorite tunes, Whammer Jammer. It's in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. Thanks a lot for listening. I remain your humble host, Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.